thank you to everyone again who helped us open the meeting with the readings. And I want to take the opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we just started, and a particular welcome to any newcomers or visitors, and a huge welcome to any newcomers to our meeting. We hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back this evening. So it does fall on me to introduce our speaker this evening. I don't know very much about this person other than the fact that we bumped into each other in a meeting on the west coast of the States a few weeks ago in the middle of the night, and I was intrigued to see he was one of the newcomers in the room, so I thought, well, it would be wonderful to get him to come and share with us. So I kind of asked and he agreed, and I'm very delighted that he did. So I'm really looking forward to what Mel has got to share with us. So I'm going to hand it over to Mel for 40, 45 minutes, and I will let you know 5 minutes before the end. Share his experience, strength, and hope. So Mel, over to you. Please share with us. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm Mel. I'm an addict.
Hi, Mel.
Hi, Mel.
Hi, Mel. Hi, Mel. Welcome.
Hi, Mel.
I love seeing faces. That's okay. I'll do this blue jeans things with voices only, and I'll accept that. Yeah, I guess I am a newcomer. My clean date is October the 7th of 1968. So I've been here for a while. And I got introduced to this fellowship through H&I. And if anybody does H&I, that's a good thing, because that's where the message gets brought. And if people find it, the hope there, they'll stick around. And things get great. I want to start off with just saying that I don't give a drug log. I think anybody in this platform knows how to use drugs, so we don't need to know any more about that. I usually just don't find it necessary to talk about that. I remember when I was new and going to meetings, and people would take you on a 20-minute tour of their drug addiction, and once in a while they'd say, and by the way, I got clean. And I thought, no, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear how people got clean and why they stayed clean. My part of NA is being part of the history. The meeting I went to inside the penitentiary, there was a couple of guys that came out. These names are just going to mean nothing to you. Unless you've read Bob Stone's My Days in NA book or something like that, just won't know these things. But a guy named Hank Magdaleno came out with another guy named Eddie Cochran. And Eddie Cochran had 17 years clean at that time. And Hank had a few years less. But he came out and noticed that he had fingers missing off of his hand. And he came from a family of about six or seven, and only one person didn't use drugs. The rest of the family used drugs. And but in fact, I thought to myself, I wonder why this guy stayed clean. He's got the saddest story I've ever heard. And yet the guy he brought, Eddie, was the funniest guy I've ever heard. And he kept yelling out, man, it's terrific out there, and this, and he made everybody laugh. And I thought, the guy must have been smoking weed before he came to the meeting. That's kind of the way I felt about it. But he had some stuff to say that left me with a feeling that I need to get this guy's phone number. And in today's world in H&I, you're not allowed to give away your phone number. I don't even know how people find you if they don't have a way to get a hold of you, unless they hunt you down and they ask questions, you know, this guy, or this gal, whatever it is, and they direct people from the meetings to where you're at. But I got this guy's phone number, and I hung on to it. I kept it real close to my little hiding places, and while I was in the penitentiary, and when I got out of there, he was the first call that I made. And I called him up and I said, hey, Eddie, this is Mel. He says, who? I said, Mel. And he says to me, well, where do I know you from, Mel? And I says, well, you brought the message of hope to me in the penitentiary. And I could just see him looking at the phone saying, huh? I've done this thing for 15 years out of my 17 years of being clean. And he said to me, "You're the first guy that's ever called me." I couldn't believe that. It didn't make sense because the guy had such a welcoming story. You wanted to know more about him. Well, to be honest with you, there was, well, I don't have to say word honest. I'm going to be honest through this whole thing. There was only 5 meetings of NA in the world at that time, and I didn't know where any of them were at. Eddie went to the very first NA meeting with Jimmy Hay as his sponsor in 1953. So I kind of felt I'm in the right spot, and with these people, I'm in the right spot. Any event, he didn't tell me where any NA meetings were at. I don't know why, but he didn't. He directed me to the other fellowship, and he asked me to hang in there a couple of days, and I'd meet him. I called him on a Monday. He said, "I'll meet you on Wednesday, and at this meeting where he was going to be at." So I didn't know what to do with myself, but I kind of just hung in there, and the things that addicts do when they have idle time with no direction. When you get out of a penitentiary, I called up an old friend of mine and says, "Hey, I just got home. I'm home." He says, "Oh, come on over. I want you to go with me someplace." And I thought, okay. So I drove over to his place, and he drove me back close to home. He took me to an amateur night topless place, beer bar. And I thought, oh, this is the last place in the world I want to be. But he says, "Come on, you can have a beer with me." And I says, no. It's not the caboose that gets you. It's the engine." I said, I'm not about to do that." So I picked it up, I sniffed it, I put it back down, and I said, "Hey, let's go." I took him back home, and I never talked to the guy for 3 years after that, because I don't want to be tempted. I mean, I learned some stuff while in the penitentiary. I decided to, or I accepted the opportunity to be the secretary of the meeting inside, and I was so enthusiastic about it that I also wanted to have a step study meeting inside. So I started a step study meeting on another night, and I also was able to when the newcomer, well, I should say, what do they call those people when the guys that just come into the penitentiary, they put you through a bunch of things you had to go through, and there was an auditorium that they all sat in, and different groups came in and pitched their things, and I was one of those people that pitched NA. I did that until I got out, and I went to the first meeting I ever went to was this AA meeting, and I was around here. Of course, you can't see me to see what I look like right now, but I'm going to describe me, which is kind of funny in my own mind. I had dark brown hair, I had my own teeth, and I was in a room full of old people, and I'm going to be 77 in October. I was in a room with old people, and a lot of them didn't have any teeth, and I laugh at that today because my teeth don't sleep with me at night. They sleep in a jar because that's age, and that's just the way things go. So, but they said some things that left me with a really kind of odd feeling. Number one, they smiled at you, and some of them didn't have any teeth and gave me the willies, but I just kind of bypassed that part. Then they said, "It's nice to have you here so young," but they didn't realize what I had to do to get there, because we all beat ourselves up pretty good, and I know I did. I wasn't a happy camper with my life. I didn't like me. I didn't like you. I didn't trust me. I didn't trust you. There's a lot of feelings I had about that in my life. Then they said things like, "Keep coming back," and I can't remember anybody who's ever told me to keep coming back anyplace. When I knocked on somebody's door, they'd kind of close the curtains and say, "Shh, don't let the guy in," because I'm the kind of guy who would probably bump on a table and burn your furniture with a cigarette, or something like that. Anyway, it's just I wasn't a clean cut all American guy. I was just a drug addict doing drug addict things. So I left that meeting with a meeting directory and said young people's meetings, under 40 meetings, just a list of meetings. In fact, I laugh at that today. Of course, you wouldn't understand that the way I do, but there was a list of 250 meetings, both in Orange County and LA County. Today, there's thousands upon thousands of meetings in each county. People get resentments and get out and go buy a coffee pot, find a room, and have a new meeting, and they split off, and that's how the growth of this fellowship grows. But so I had gone to several different meetings, and I went to the third meeting I ever went to was a meeting that Jimmy Kay himself went to before he started NA, and he was encouraged by some of the members there that he needed to start a fellowship for drug addicts only because AA isn't for drug addicts, it's just for alcoholics. But they used the old ANDA in there, and ANDA never got you any more brownie points, but it's still the purest alcoholic doesn't want to hear anything about drugs. And Eddie always told me if you go to AA meeting, you say you're an alcoholic. If you go to an NA meeting, say you're an addict, and that way they can't deny you a time to share. But I walked into this meeting, and it was half gay and half straight. I didn't know anything about that. That didn't bother me a bit. And I just went into the meeting, and I went up and got myself a 9-month chip. I called Eddie. I said, "Eddie, I just got a 9-month chip." He says, "What'd you do that for?" I says, "Well, I've been clean. I was secretary of a meeting. I did this and that." He says, "No, man, your time starts on the streets." So I said, "Okay." And I went back the following Friday night and turned my chip in with my tail between my legs and went through the gamut of the 30-day chips. We didn't have all these key tags. You've got all kinds of times with these key tags. We didn't have a 60-day key tag. We didn't have an 18-month key tag. We didn't even have a year key tag at that time. We had poker chips. And they always said if you can bite through this poker chip, you can go out and get loaded again. And I thought, no, I don't want to bite through a little poker chip. But I collected all of them. In fact, up in my room, my bedroom, I have a box of those three chips that I collected, and as a reminder to me. I've heard it said so many times, like relapse isn't part of my story. I decided no matter how many times I wanted to go back out and use again, because I've had disappointments in my life. We all do. We all have certain things that happen to us that we just can't get away from. But I always thought it through because I was told to just think the thing completely through. And the thing that I kept thinking about, if I was to use again, I'd wind up back in a penitentiary. And that's where I realized the first step was the most important step that I had to follow through with. That was that I realized I was powerless over my addiction and my life had become manageable. And how I recognized that is being in that penitentiary. I'm in a dorm, not just a cell. I'm in a dorm with 64 other guys, and I might have been the only one in the shower, and all of a sudden I had 12 guys wanting to wash my back, and I thought, man, that's the last place in the world I want to be around a bunch of weirdos. And so I made it a point to stay clean no matter what. And after a period of time, it took about almost 3 months before I was directed to an NA meeting. I went to the mother group, as they called it, the Moorpark and Rhodes. And I saw Jimmy, and I saw a guy named Bob Barrett and Bill Beck and Gene Haig and several people that are in the history that have passed away, no longer alive, but they saw these people and they said that the language I wanted to hear. They talked about drug addiction and how they recovered. And so I was really excited about that. And being that I live about 12 miles east of Los Angeles, and most of the five meetings that were around were pretty far away. And back then, the gas was 25 cents a gallon. It seemed like it was taking me 45 minutes to an hour to make it to a meeting. But I was talking to the young man that was in this, young man, this guy that was in the here when I first got here early this morning. Morning for me, it's not evening. It's only almost 10:30. But he had to take a boat or something. It took him a couple of days to get to a meeting. That's why they started the Blue Jeans thing or did something on. I think that's cool that you're doing what you're doing. I love these alternate meetings where this pandemic has caused us to revert back to old things that we had to do, and that's desperation to find a place to go to listen to recovery. Anyway, when I found that meeting, I was really excited. I went to four of the five meetings. I didn't get to the fifth one, but I felt I need to do something more. So I spoke at a Naranon meeting, and the pastor of the church that was that had the church was sitting in on this Naranon. And I gave a short pitch and gave my story and probably went into depth on my usage and stuff like that, because you didn't know what to say back in those days, and I didn't have the working knowledge of the steps at that time. But he said to me, he says, "Hey, would you like to start an NA meeting here?" And I said, "You know what? That sounds like a pretty decent idea." So the first Monday of 1969, not too far from where I live right now, I put together a meeting, and the only person that was there is the guy I told the night before. But as the weeks went on, more and more people would show up. And then I lit a fire under four of the people, and they started meetings within our area. And we didn't call it area, we just called it NA. We didn't have areas and regions and all that stuff back then. We just had NA. And I spent some time with Jimmy. And Jimmy was getting letters from all over the world about information needed for NA, and he would get starter kits out and send starter kits to all these places. And it might have been Scotland, it might have been Africa, it might have been any place, just France, could have been any place around the world. He would just get so excited, like a little kid in a candy store. "Wow, look at this, Mel. Look how many, these people from all over are just asking me about NA." And his whole life was to want to see this become a worldwide fellowship. And I'm going to talk about that, if I can remember, talk about that just a little bit later on in this talk I'm giving. But I was excited about being around Jimmy, but Jimmy was more excited about being around me. And he spoon-fed me what NA was all about, and he gave me the enthusiasm to do more. And we didn't have a World Service office. We didn't have NAS back then. His office was in his kitchen, and that's where he did most of his work for NA. And he spent all the money out of his pocket to do what he had to do. He never received any money from any groups or any other people. And it wasn't until I had the opportunity to go with my sponsor to a judge's courtroom after hours. He had a school called Alcohol School. And he kept talking about alcohol school. What he was doing with this, and he have a diversion program where people like me would share their experience, strength, and hope, and give them a little bit of hope. And once that they had so many sessions in, they completed it. But they completed it by going to regular 12-step meetings and getting a court card signed. And I raised my hand and I said, "Your Honor, you're talking about alcohol school, and alcohol is the oldest known drug. Why doesn't the addict have the same privilege?" And he thought to himself, "You know, you're right." So he changed the name from Alcohol School to DANA, Drug, Alcohol, Narcotic Awareness. And it turned out that the parole office that I was part of because I was on parole for 2 or 3 years. Most of the people that were parole officers were leading these classes in different schools, and they would have me come in and other people come in, and we'd give our pitch, and they'd give you honorariums, and it could have been anywhere from 10 to 25 to $50. And I said, Eddie, what do I do with this money? And he says, well, it costs you gas and wear and tear in your car, and just put it in your pocket. And I thought, no, I can't do that, because I heard it said that you can't keep what you have unless you give it away, and this is a free program, and we do it out of love, and we do it out of compassion. So I just thought to myself, I can't keep this money, and that's my seven tradition money. I'm gonna anything I pay for gasoline is just money that I take it out of my own pocket. And but I took all that money that I earned and sent it to NA, and I was a single most contributor amount of money that was received, and that went to Jimmy to help with the postage, so you didn't have to worry about postage all the time and carrying this message. But the enthusiasm was deep in my gut. I just loved Narcotics Anonymous, and I still do to this very day. And they saw me as a person that was willing to do things. And there's people that are audience, and there's people that get involved. They always said service is the number one thing that keeps you going. So I was first thing I did was become chairman of the H&I, and I took a panel into the penitentiary that I came out of for 5 years. And then they had a general service organization. We didn't call it an office because we really didn't have an office. There's a story in the back of the white pamphlet, and I think probably in the first basic text in the stories of the Fat Addict. This guy was a barber, and we did a lot of meetings in his barber shop, and then we established some other places that we would meet at, and so we were floating around having general service meetings, and I was the chairman for that for a year until I passed it on to somebody else. But I always went to the meetings. I just enjoyed the service meetings that we did. And then I got invited to be a participant as a member of the First World Board of Trustees. And that was the guardian of the traditions. That was our job. And we would serve at the World Service conferences and sit back and listen to see if anybody was violating the traditions. And we'd have a couple words with those people or bring it up for the whole group, the whole place to hear. And that was kind of interesting. I had a 5 year term with that, and that was really cool. I'm saying these things not to brag. I'm just saying this is part of my history, and I feel funny about talking about this stuff, but I was told that you need to share these things that you did because this is what you did in NA, and this is why I'm so eager to continue doing what I do. Even at my age, I might not be able to get up and move around like I used to, but I can do it verbally, and I can do a lot of things that I want to do. So here's the last little thing that I did in service was I went up to Bob and I said, Bob, I'd like to have a world convention. And he looked at me and he says, well, Mel, where are you going to have that? And you'd have to be familiar with the area in California. I said, I'd like to have it at the Anaheim Convention Center or the LA Convention Center. And he laughed. He thought that was the funniest thing he ever heard. So why are you laughing at me? He says, well, Mel, where are you going to get that kind of money to rent that place? Because those things aren't cheap. And where are you going to find that many people? And I thought about it and I says, well, yeah, you're right. But I didn't let that go away from my head. And I got five other people, and we met on a regular basis. This was at the beginning of the year of 1971. And we got together on a regular basis, and we found a place to have it. And we had in November 1971 at a country club, a golf country club, we had 250 people show up, 185 that paid, and the rest were freebies out of recovery houses. Registration was pretty expensive. It was $5, and the dinner ticket was $10. I mean, compared to what we have to pay today to go to a convention, whether it's a local one or a world convention, this is nothing. But the emotions that we had after the convention was over was unreal. People crying, didn't want it to end. We stood outside after the spiritual speaker spoke, and we just wept. And yet we wept with joy that we had the opportunity. And Jimmy was a part of this thing. Bob was a part of this thing. We had a guy named Jack Whaley, and he had a strange story, but he was part of this thing too. And he did a lot for NA. He did something to me that kind of turned me sideways. I used to see Jack at this one meeting in Manhattan Beach, and we had this meeting. It's still going to this very day, except it's virtual now. It's not a live meeting. But I walked in to say, "Hi, Jack, how you doing?" He said, "I'm doing okay." And 1 week I walked in there after coming there a month or 2 months. I says, "I was just thinking about you, Jack." And he says, "That's funny, I don't think about you at all." And I thought, oh my, that was a hurtful feeling that he said. And I found out why. He doesn't like to get newcomers into his heart, because newcomers have a tendency to go right back out. And when they go back out, it tears him up. So he says, he told other people, "I'm not going to let a newcomer get close to me until they got 2 years." And he told me the same thing. He says, "Come back and talk to me when you get a couple years in." So I'd show up at that meeting every Friday night. I'd put my hand out and shake his hand and sit down. And he was the kind of guy that you don't talk about your job. You don't talk about your wife. You don't talk about your kids and your car, all that junk. You're supposed to share experience, strength, and hope. And if you stood up and started whining about this, it's like Whiners Anonymous, he would say, "Hey, quit. Stop talking." And if you still continue to talk, he'd pick up a chair and throw it at you. And I watched him do several times. I thought, oh, man, this guy's mean. But when I got 2 years, him and I went out to have a bite to eat, and we talked, and we became close friends. And that guy died playing volleyball, which was his favorite sport, on the beach. And it was just sad to see him go. But there's some more influence people that had with me. They spoon-fed me and how to be kind to a newcomer, how to talk to a newcomer and give them the hope that was given to me. Always give it away. Never stop giving it away. So we had that first convention, and it was just a wonderful experience. And it just made me more enthusiastic to do more things. And we watched this fellowship grow and grow and grow. And I remember, and this is one thing that probably one of the best things that ever happened. I can always say one of the best things. It's always a good thing. But they invited me to come speak at the 50-year anniversary of NA in 2003 at a world convention. And they wanted me to speak on a panel of, there was going to be 10 of us up there on this platform, and talk about the early days of the mother group. "Oh, that's kind of interesting." I said, "Yeah, I'll do that. I'd be glad to do that." So they even had us rehearse to get up on this platform, and they showed, I don't know if you get to see these things over where you guys are at, but at most conventions they'll show a movie, and it's the early days, a tribute to Jimmy, and I was asked to be a part of that too, but just different things that we did. But Jimmy also had early days, and he talked about the different meetings that he was able to be involved with, including the Survivors Club, which was just a club that they had for addicts. And I never went there personally, because I heard everybody was getting shot and beat up, and I said, "Well, it's not the place I want to go, and plus it's an hour ride to get there." So I never made it to that place that I can remember anyway. But that That was an exciting experience. But what they did is they darkened the room and started showing the movie of all the places that, and he, showed him driving his car or his little truck and going to these different places. And when the movie was over, they had us get up on this platform with the lights completely off underneath a lamppost. And they built a facade of a back end of the church, which was really kind of cool. So when the movie stopped, the lamppost light went on, and the guy yelled out, the leader of the meeting yelled, "Okay, it's meeting time." We had to walk through a door, and we had to bend down so they couldn't see through the lighting that we were coming through this other door. And we walk into the meeting spot, and we sit down and into the semicircle of chairs, and we had two readers, a leader, and seven of us that had a chance to share. And most of the people, except for one guy, Don, is and Jack is another one that's still alive, but most of those people that were on that platform had passed away. But I've shared the story of the first convention, and all of a sudden I found myself crying in front of all these people, because I looked out in the room and there was 25,000 people that could afford to make this convention that was there. And I thought to myself, totally caught off guard. I had no idea Jimmy's dream was starting to come true. And that's only part of his dream. I mean, he didn't he lost his spot in the world service. They took his key, they changed the locks to his office, and somebody stole that thing away from him. It's a long story, I don't want to talk about it. Kind of upsets me every time I think about it. But they hurt Jimmy, and Jimmy had he had lung problems to begin with, and that was the nail in the coffin that killed him. And but again, I don't really want to talk about it. I get upset when I talk about that. But I stuck it out in NA no matter what. I just kept going. And those days, I mean, we had a lot of the reasons that some of this stuff is pretty expensive to go to is it costs a lot of money to rent these facilities, and they make up some of it with having the merchandise for sale. That's another pet peeve of mine, that we didn't have merchandise on the first convention. In fact, we didn't have merchandise for many years, and then all of a sudden this t-shirts and jewelry and all that stuff would be starting to filter in, and they would tap into the profits that these guys were making to help support the convention, which I thought was kind of weird too. But nothing stopped me from wanting to do more in NA. And I've been a secretary of a meeting, I've been a treasurer of a meeting, I've been a set up and clean up guy. I washed coffee cups when we had real coffee cups in meetings instead of styrofoam cups. We actually have to wash out ashtrays because we were labeled to smoke in meetings, which today I'm really grateful we don't. That stuff would just choke me. But I've done everything there is to do, and I really have, because I've shared it with you already. H and I on the World Board, just all these things. And there's one thing I will never, ever, ever be again, though, is a GSR. I'm not good for confrontation, arguments, and fights. And so somebody wants to be a GSR, more power to them. That's just not for me. But I'll still serve. In fact, I served as a greeter in my home group for a long period of time until the pandemic came in, and no longer do we have physical meetings. But I used to sit back in this one spot where the people come through the door, and if I noticed that you were a newcomer, if I've never seen you before, I'd put out my hand and welcome you to the meeting. And if you were new, I always ask, "Are you new to the fellowship?" And they said yes. I would try to learn their name, and if it was a girl, I'd introduce them to some of the girls. You know, we have a tendency, there's several things we have a tendency to do in meetings today. Of course, you guys are just doing, you're just basically doing online meetings, but there's several things that we do when we go to real meetings is we sit around and we just shoot the breeze with people, and we don't even pay attention to the newcomer. Or in regular meetings too, you have a tendency to with phones these days. I mean, when I came into the fellowship, we didn't have beepers, let alone cell phones. You see people doing social media in the meetings and not paying attention to the new people that are coming through the door. And I think to myself, that's lousy. That's horrible. And several meetings I go to that we had it written into the intro of the meeting that we're no longer allowing people to have cell phones. If you're in a meeting with a cell phone, you turn it off, or in some cases, leave it on vibrate if you had to. But if you're on a meeting on a phone, we're going to ask you to go ahead and find a meeting that might accommodate you, but you can't do it here. And I remember one guy in particular at a meeting I go to, pretty far away from here, and his rules are just strict. And I've watched him with a handful of meeting directories walk up to a guy, and their phones light up because it's a candlelight meeting, and even if it's in their pocket, and he can see the reflection in their pocket. He w goes up to a guy, grabs him by the shoulder, takes him outside the meeting, and hands him a meeting directory. He says, "You got to go, unless you can turn that thing completely off. I mean, that's not on vibrate. You got to be completely off. We come here for recovery only. We don't come here for social media." And I remember going to a meeting one time and speaking, and a gal yelled, screamed out loud, and everybody stopped and I said, "This guy's looking at porno. So that's just one more reason you don't use a phone at a meeting. We come here for recovery only. And if you're serious about recovery, that's what you do. And if you're not serious about recovery, well, you know, there's that old story that the people that play Russian roulette are struggling, but there's more people dying from this disease of drug addiction than there is from people that are, there's just a lot of people going, especially with the pandemic, all the depression and all the stuff that's going on. There's just people committing suicide or just saying the heck with it, and they go back out and do what they got to do. But that's some of the early days and some of the events that I can remember that were vivid in my mind. And but being the greeter at meeting just gave me purpose, and it also encouraged people to get involved in the meeting. You can be a participant and listen and listen and listen, and finally one day says, "You know, what am I doing here? You know, there's nothing for me to do. I just sitting there listening to some of these stories." And some of the stories, there's going to be some whiners, this stuff that you whine about, you need to take to your sponsor. And you need to take it to the coffee shop. But in a meeting, you want to know why a person stays clean. How did they get clean, and why do they stay clean? Those are some of the two most important things. And so I try to do that. And I haven't talked too much about the steps here. I talked about the first one because that was the one that kept me here. But I don't talk. I forgot that there's more to talking about than just history. And for me, the second step, I had a hard time with the second step because they kept saying be restored to sanity. And I thought to myself, I don't want what I used to have. I don't want to be restored. I want to be better than that. I can't just settle for just being restored. So I looked at that and said, no, there's got to be more to it. Well, that comes to pass when you do step three, is making the decision, turn your will and your life over the care of God. And I didn't have that much of a hardship on that. I'm a little Jewish guy, but down the road, well, 32 years ago almost, I made a decision and I became a religious guy. But I'm not going to talk about that. But I found a God that I can talk to that loves me, and he's forgiven me, and I feel comfortable with that. But I had to make the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. But I don't know about you guys, that addicts have a tendency to give it to God and then take it back, and give it and take it back, and give it and take it back. We have a tendency to fight with that because it's a difficult thing to turn your will and your life over to something you can't see, can't feel, can't hear. You have to do it on blind faith and know that whatever you do is going to turn out okay. And then it comes down to step four. I fought for this for a long time. I you don't wake up in the morning singing zippity-doo-dah, I think I'll work a four step. That's just not the way it works out. Well, what does take place is that you wind up in some kind of pain, and I did. I committed a crime clean that could have put me in a penitentiary for 5 years, and or more, who knows? And I know my sponsor was saying, "Hey, man, it's time to work them steps," because I was always dodging him. I would say, "Hey, but Eddie, I've got this meeting to go to, or that to do. Never have time for that sitting down and working steps." And but all of a sudden I found myself in a lot of pain, and I broke out. And by the way, we didn't have a basic text. We didn't have Living Clean. We didn't have all the literature that you have today in many different languages. All we had was the Liquid Fellowship's book, the big book, and the 12 and 12, and we just had that to go on. Hazleton had some publications also, and one of them was the Little Red Book, and you could read the steps in the Little Red Book, and that was how I worked my fourth step. And I went to a guy to do my fourth step, and it wasn't my sponsor, because my sponsor kind of let me down. He didn't follow up with me after I got in myself in legal problems to see if I was doing okay. And of course, it wasn't his job. It's my job to call him. I felt it was the other way around. He needed to check up on me. And other people did, but he didn't. So I went to this guy who was chairman of the board of trustees, Chuck Skinner, and he's gone too. What a wonderful guy he was. But he was a mean guy, mean. He used a lot of vile language, but he was a pretty mean guy. And I made an appointment with him to do my fifth step. And the day I was going over there, I called him up and says, "You never hurt anybody you've done a fifth step with, have you?" He said, "No." So I said, "Okay." And I went over there, and he took me through his house, and he took me to his trailer. He says, "Get in." And I got in, and then he blocked the door. Which left me with real uncomfortable feeling. So I just said, "No, you got to do this, Mel. Don't hide the thing. You've got it written down. You've got stuff in your head. Get it out." And so he says, "Start reading." So I started reading, and when I got all done, which took some time, he says, "Is that all you've got?" And I says, "Yeah." He says, "I thought you were sicker than that." And kind of chuckled, and I says, "Well," he says, "now listen to me." And he says, "This is all," and he started telling me everything he did. And I've started to feel a sense of relief, like, well, maybe I'm not as sick as I thought I was. But I saw the program of identification that we're not unique, we're not special, we're just people that have had difficult times, and we've all had the same experiences in different forms, but we've all had the same experiences. And I didn't walk out of there with feeling totally relieved. In fact, it took a couple of days. I was driving along and kind of thought about the events that took place, and I realized, wow, I dumped my whole life on this guy. And I felt that sense of relief, like, oh, that's cool. And I knew he wasn't the kind of guy that would stand up from a podium or at a round table discussion and say, "Hey, I just did a fifth step with a guy. You're not going to believe what he told me." He wasn't that kind of guy. Whatever he heard, he kept to himself. And that was okay. I felt comfortable with that. And he died also. And it's just, I've lost so many friends. You know, when it gets down to a, well, let me finish with the steps before I go there. He introduced me to step six and seven, and he said he pointed out some of the character defects. I don't know about you guys, but there are some character defects that once you learn about them, you say to yourself, you know, those are still good. I like those, just like chocolate ice cream. I like those. And even though you might be gaining weight, yeah, I like those. He told me one time, he says, you do things that make you feel comfortable. When you start to feel uncomfortable, you discontinue with doing those things. And that's how you learn to let God take away those character defects and shortcomings. And slowly but surely, in time, you remove yourself from them, and you start to feel like a worthwhile human being, full of compassion and love and care, just like was gave to you, you're going to get back. And I couldn't sponsor people back then because in the early days, because I personally hadn't worked the steps. I had nothing to give away. And the people that were asking me to sponsor weren't staying clean. They were going back out and using. So I realized that I didn't have it to give away. So why, you're going to have to work the steps in order to get it to give it away. So when I got done with six and seven, I knew I had to make a list of people that I had harmed, and I sat down and I worked out all these people, and some of them maybe took me a while to remember, but I remembered them, then I got that on paper, and I knew that step nine, I'm going to have to make some amends. And in step nine, it says make amends, direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when I do injure them or others. And I thought, okay, if I've slept with somebody's wife, I don't necessarily go up to the guy and says, hey man, I'm really sorry I slept with your wife. That's not what you do. Well, what you do is you make a living amends by never going around and sleeping with other people's wives again. So you stop doing things that were destructive, and you start becoming more productive. And I thought, that's what I need to do. I need to change my lifestyle to be a better person. And so from the steps, I've learned to do a lot of great things. And then I followed it up with 10, 11, and 12. 10 is something I think about daily. You know, did I make any mistakes today? Did I hurt anybody's feelings today? Did I do this or did I do that? And then clean it up before you go to bed at night. That way you don't have to think about it tomorrow. You don't have to worry about, oh man, I'm gonna run into that person. Am I gonna have to say something again? You know, it festers in you that you need to go back and do these things. And 11 wasn't a very difficult thing for me after 32 years ago when I accepted the idea that I needed a God in my life. And I'll say this and then I'll shut up about it, is that I have now the basic text that helps me stay clean. And I have the word Bible that stands for basic instruction before leaving Earth. And it gives me kindness, it gives me compassion, it gives me a feeling that I've never had before. I have the feeling of being loved just like in the fellowship. And I've heard it said that people that start going to church have a tendency to go out and use again. But if you have a balance in your life, you can do anything you want to do and you can do it all. And that's what I do today. And I follow through with that. I'm dedicated to the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous because it gave me life. And I'm dedicated to the church I belong to because it gave me hope. And it gave me, well, I'm not going to get into that. And then it gets down to sponsorship. You know, I had Eddie for 30 years and he died of cancer. And I remember him saying to me that, because I made that decision before he died. And he said, well, why don't you go to your God and pray for that my cancer will go away? And I says, Eddie, you have a God? He says, no, the only God I have is in a program. And so he felt hopeless that he didn't have what I had. He saw the changes in me, but he couldn't grab a hold of it for himself. And it probably wouldn't have mattered anyway, because cancer is a life taker. But he died. And then I was thinking, what am I going to do now? Here's a guy I've trusted for so long. And so I went out and I started to look for another sponsor. Thought about Hank, the guy that brought Eddie. And just before I could call him, bless it, just before I could call him, he died. And I decided to go with Hank's brother, and Hank's brother was an unusual kind of a guy. Gotta let my dog out here. Come on, get He inventoried everything he thought about. Everything he thought about, he'd have to inventory. And I thought, oh, this guy's kind of unusual. Well, do I really want to go with him? But he had a heart. He was really a pleasant guy. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and he sponsored me for 5 years, and then he died. I thought, oh boy, this is a chore. So then I had to go out and look for another guy, and I found this guy Gordon, who's a biker type, and he was a marshmallow, but he was also rough, and I had him for 5 years, and all of a sudden, his wife calls me up and said, "Man, I woke up in the morning and Gordon was old in bed. He died." Oh man! So then I was challenged. I mean, a sponsorship to me is most important thing, because if you sponsor yourself, you've got a fool for your sponsor. So sponsorship is really important. You got to have somebody. You can't trust yourself. And even though if you've worked all the steps, you've done all those things, it's still you have thinking goes on. And once in a while, you think something, and you're not sure about it, you want to call up the sponsor and say, "Hey, what do you think of this?" And they laugh at you or say, "Yeah, that's a good idea." One of the two, but you get to do that. So I got a hold of Gene Haig. He moved out of the area. He was up in Oregon. He was an unusual guy, but he says, "I really don't sponsor people, Mel, but we've been friends for a long time. I'll sponsor you for a while." So I says, "Okay, Gene, that's great. At least I have somebody, you know." And we talk all the time because we're friends. We talk all the time. And then one day I found another guy, and it was difficult, though. I mean, every time I trying to go find a sponsor, I tell them the story about every sponsor I had died. And they said, "Well, hey, do me a favor. Don't ask me. They don't want to be on the list of death people." So I said, "Okay." So I got this other guy, and I still have him today. He's part of the other fellowship, but he's quite the guy. And in fact, he sponsors, my best friend, Norman. And at least he was my best friend up to about 2 weeks ago. I don't know what happened to him. And he sponsors Danny T. And Danny's a celebrity in the movies and all that. In fact, Danny, when I told him, when I got my 9-month chip, the first meeting I went to, and Eddie told me that my time starts on the streets and not in air. Danny came and celebrated his 50 years at my home group. And we were pretty close friends for a long time. But I said, "Danny, when'd you get out of the penitentiary?" He says, "I got out in 1969. He says, "When'd you get out, Mel?" I said, "I got out in 68. I realized he counted his joint time. And so I told him the story about my nine-month chip, and I had to take it back. And he says, "Well, you should have gotten a different sponsor." And I thought, "No, I got one date. And my date's carved in stone. I'm not going to change it. I'm satisfied with my date, and I'll be happy with it." You know, Narcotics Anonymous has given me a dream, my dreams beyond my wildest dreams. It's given me everything that I've ever thought I would have. In fact, if I had to write a story about what I expected out of my life when I first got clean, I would have undersold what was given to me. And what I have in my life today. I still love to go to meetings when we do have meetings. I love to read the literature. The most fun book I enjoy is Living Clean. That book is really good. I know that when we had literature being written in the early days, you had Bo and you had Greg Pierce and you had Sally Evans, and you had a bunch of people who were helping write this literature. and a lot of people get disgusted. And why do we have so many editions? The first edition, the second edition, the third edition. And the one that stands out to be one of the best ones is the fifth edition. And yet you have six, and I think they're going to rewrite. Somebody gets angry and they says, I don't like this word here. Let's change it. So they have to rewrite everything. And maybe they want to add in some stories to go with it. But that's just a moneymaker compared to some of the other people's fellowships where they have one book with the same 164 pages that were written. And that stands the same. Stories change, but everything else stays the same. But there's something that's inside of me that says, no matter how old I am, I got to continue to give this thing away. If I don't give it away, I can't keep it. There's history that I've shared with you. And maybe you'll walk away and say to yourself, yeah, this guy had a fairly decent pitch. I like what he had to say. And you absorb some of these things, and you're going to be able to talk about the guy that started the world first NA convention, and this guy was this and he did that. But then stop and remember that your story is just as important. So you're going to add to your story and remember some of the things that were shared. And one day you're going to have a bunch of years, and somebody's going to invite you to share at a meeting, and you're going to be able to share the same history. You're going to be able to give them the hope and give them confidence that they can move on. And it's not just a one person program. It's a we program where all of us play an important part. All of us have something to say. All of us need to remember where we came from, so we'll never have to return. Just one of my pet sayings is that I don't ever want my past to become my present. I just don't want it to happen. I really enjoy my life today, and I have a lot to be grateful for. So with that, I think I'm going to just say appreciate the opportunity to share with you folks. I'm glad for the invitation to be able to come and share with you. I didn't get to see faces, which Zoom is where I get to see faces, and I know if I'm connecting or not connecting. I can only imagine that maybe some of you are shaking your head saying, what? And the others are saying, yeah, that's cool. But and if there's some new people in here, I'm hoping I gave you something of a choice too, so that you can shake that hand of a newcomer or hear the voice and make that person feel welcome in your meeting. That's what it's all about. We can only keep what we have by giving it away, and we can, by the more we give away, the more we get back. Thanks for letting me participate in your meeting.